It's really detrimental and damaging to people's sense of belonging. And why would you expect somebody to continue to contribute to a society that doesn't want them?
Welcome back to Rightscast, a podcast from the Human Rights Centre at the University of Essex. In this episode, we'll be taking a closer look at the hostile environment, a set of policies designed by the UK government intended to make the lives of illegal immigrants so difficult that they eventually leave the country. A significant element of the hostile environment is the no recourse to public funds policy. Later, we'll hear from Koldo Kassler, lecturer at Essex Law School and deputy director of the Human Rights Clinic, who has previously worked in civil society in the UK on social and economic rights, including on issues relating to no recourse to public funds. But first, Dara Murray is joined by Kimberly Garande, outreach officer at We Belong, and Andy Jolly, a research associate at the Institute for Community Research and Development at the University of Wolverhampton, to discuss what the policy is and the impact it has on those subject to it.
So maybe we could start just with introductions and kind of you explaining where you come at this issue from.
So yeah, my name is Kimberly Garande and I'm the outreach officer at We Belong. I guess I'm coming at this issue from, you know, being part of an active group of campaigners who campaign for a shorter, more affordable route to settlement, as well as equal access to higher education. And all of us don't have access to public funds.
So for me, it was, I suppose my interest in this started off was, I'm a social worker by background, and I was managing a project in the voluntary sector, working with destitute families who had no recourse to public funds and had become destitute through that status. And I found that they were just completely invisibilised in the discussion around child poverty, but also around safeguarding and welfare. So there was an assumption that people were experiencing neglect as a result of action by a parent or a caregiver, but there was very little discussion about the kind of structural factors of neglect. And child poverty discussions tended to focus around issues around social security sanctions and whether social security benefits were high enough. But obviously for people with no recourse to public funds, they're completely excluded from that debate because they don't have any access to social security benefits in the first place. So that's why I was really interested in this issue, because I think it's really important to visibilise the experiences of people with no recourse to public funds in order to make sure that they are able to access their rights.
So before we get into no recourse to public funds specifically, for people who don't know, what is the hostile environment?
The hostile environment is a discriminatory set of policies. They're put in place, I guess, to control every aspect of migrant life. So the purpose being to create unlivable conditions in which your freedom and opportunity is just non-existent, and it's restricted from that individual, forcing them to either leave or just prolong hardships. I think that's the best way I can describe that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary. But I mean, a lot of the discussion around the hostile environment talks about, you know, Theresa May and her policies when she was Home Secretary from, you know, there was the interview in, I think, the Daily Telegraph in 2012. But I think it's important to emphasise that, you know, this is a longer trend in immigration policy. You know, the phrase, the hostile environment, was used in the New Labour era in 2007. Oh. Liam Byrne was talking about, you know, using the exact same phrase. And the idea that it's possible or desirable to encourage people to leave the country by making things difficult has a really long history. So it's both a recent phenomenon, but it's got a long past as well.
It's interesting. I had no idea that it preceded the term that it had preceded Theresa May. I guess by its nature and by the phrase itself, it's deliberately not a very welcoming policy, but it must have a very significant impact on people just psychologically in terms of, you know, being targeted by a hostile environment policy that is almost deliberately othering people. And, you know, as you say, trying to make conditions so unbearable that they just leave. I don't know if you have experience of what's that like for people, or how it affects their place in society.
I think it creates an idea of, I guess, mixed identity, because many migrants who've, you know, moved to the UK, whether in seek of refuge or to build a family life, don't still feel as though the UK is their home, despite all the contributions that they've made to society or the communities that they've lived in. And I don't feel as though the hostile environment, the way in which it's placed, it doesn't matter how long you've lived, you're still not welcome, you're still an other. And there's an idea of, I feel like, a hierarchy to entitlement. So because you're from a different place, maybe because you've got a different passport, there is a sense of there is no belonging, there is no true British identity with you. So with that, I think migrants tend to be at the bottom. And that's why, I mean, you mentioned, Andy, there's a sense of them feeling, you know, I guess, forgotten, because you're building up and putting so much money into society, but there is so many restrictions to your living. There is no access of anything. All you can do is give, 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 and there's nothing that you can take back. I mean, I was looking into welfare chauvinism, and I think it was that idea of belonging and, you know, a nation's wealth and welfare only belonging to the people that are from there.
Yeah, and there's a real disconnect between people's experiences and their kind of formal legal status. So we don't know a huge amount about, you know, this particular group of particularly children and families, because there's not a lot of research about it. But I mean, there was some research by Nando Sigona and Vanessa Hughes a few years ago now. And around half of undocumented young people, so that's young people who don't have the right to remain in the UK, around half of those were born in the UK. So that they might have grown up here, and they might not even know that they're undocumented until they apply for university. Mm. So they might identify as British, but are formally not British. And so that kind of disconnect between people's identity and how the government treats them is, I think, a real problem. You can see that probably the most notorious example of the hostile environment was the Go Home vans, Operation Varkin. And so when you're sending vans around ethnically diverse areas and telling people who were born in the UK to go home, that's quite problematic.
In terms of the no recourse to public funds policy, what is it, you know, as a policy, and where does it come from?
I mean, it's a condition placed on people with temporary status, and it just restricts people from accessing mainstream funds. So whether it's, I don't know, job seekers allowance or housing benefit. But I think it's mainly for people with temporary status who are prevented from accessing it. But it's supposed to be, you know, any benefits that support people from low income backgrounds. If you've got that condition, then you can't access it. And it's mainly for temporary migrants, if I'm correct. So people with limited leave to remain. So again, limited leave in the name that, you know, you've got conditions to your stay. You've got a time cap on when you would have to apply again to continue your stay. Or undocumented migrants, maybe work or student visas. But it's just that cap on you can't access any support.
Yeah. And it's something that's been extended as time has gone on. So, you know, it was extended to people who were given limited leave to remain on family and private life in, I think it was 2012. But it existed before that. For student and work visas. And it's something which has just been kind of gradually extended from focusing around, particularly around asylum seekers initially and temporary migrants, and then gradually it's extended more and more. And it's likely that EEA nationals, after the end of the transition period, will also fit under the no recourse to public funds condition as well.
So the idea, as I kind of hear it from you, is that it's something placed on migrants, and quite a large category of migrants, to prevent them, I guess, and using air quotes deliberately, from being a burden to the state, is, I guess, how the motivation is perceived behind it, so that they can stay in the country with associated conditions but can never have access to social welfare.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's in the immigration rules now, and it's associated with the 1999 Act. But I mean, it's something which there's a really, really long history, much like, you know, the wider hostile environment. There's a really long history behind it. So you can see, so in the Aliens Act in 1905, that created kind of different categories of desirability. And one of those was whether someone was likely to become a burden on the public purse. So again, it's a modern rule in its current form. But that kind of history of welfare chauvinism is really long.
And it's been extended, to be fair, to be a catch-all policy. And I guess I'd like to see it from the point of it's seen as a privilege in which the migrant, I guess, communities are not seen to be deserving of. Because I'm sure you touch on this a bit later, but even looking at the current pandemic, where there are so many people who are struggling, particularly, you know, people from migrant backgrounds who have this condition, who are in need of support. There was such a debate on the consideration of that condition being lifted, despite evidence of people being destitute, being homeless, suffering. And it just, it's astonishing and quite shocking. But I think the way in which it's, I guess, described or put into place, it's, you know, if you are a temporary migrant, then you are not deserving of it because you're not permanent. So as a migrant, you're working towards that permanent residence, but the goalpost forever keeps moving forward. So you, I guess you will never really get to that place, no matter how much you're struggling. And I think that's what's really unsettling about it, that is purposefully put into place to restrict and withhold large numbers of people in one place. There is no progress, there is no development. And again, we'll touch on this a little bit later, on the different aspects of life that it controls, that keeps you in limbo, essentially.
I think that's really important, isn't it, to acknowledge that it is deliberate. I think sometimes when people talk about some of the impacts of the no recourse to public funds rules specifically and the hostile environment generally, and what actually that does to people, I think there's a temptation for kind of governments to say, oh, well, that's an anomaly. But, you know, this is deliberately put in place to make things difficult. And that's by, you know, government's own admission. If you look at that 2012 Theresa May interview, she's saying, we want to make life difficult. This is the purpose of the policy, to make things difficult. I've written about this and I talk about statutory neglect. So it's neglect that is deliberate, but on a kind of legislative level. It's kind of writing neglect into law.
From the categories of people you're talking about, it affects a huge number of people. Like, the no recourse to public funds it's not a niche thing affecting a small category of migrants, but it must affect thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we don't know for sure how many people it does affect, because there's no the Office of National Statistics don't keep that information. We know a bit about the subcategories, so depending on which figures you look at, but there's probably about 1 million undocumented migrants in the UK. So that's people who don't have leave to remain here in breach of the immigration rules. And around 215,000 of those are likely to be children. But then there's a wider number of people who are here, you know, on temporary visas or have got limited leave to remain. There's some analysis by the Children's Society recently. There's probably likely to be around 1 million of them. We don't know for sure. So these are large numbers.
What are the impacts of no recourse to public funds on people, on people's lives? You know, I suppose, when does it start to affect them, and what are the impacts of it?
I think some of the impacts include destitution. I briefly mentioned currently now in a time of a pandemic, whereby you will find, I guess, a large number of migrants that are in low income jobs. And you are finding people are risking catching or contracting the virus by continuing to go to work, because they have to either pay to pay for their stay, for their application or their renewal to stay in the UK, or simply just to support themselves and their families. So I'd say destitution is definitely an impact. But not only that, but I mean, there was some reports on hunger and starvation and how much asylum seekers have to live on a day. I think it was less than £5, something really shocking. I think we also have to look at, you know, the mental impacts of NRPF being restricted to such a condition for a very long period of time. Almost then, again, like I was saying, makes you question your sense of belonging in this community, in this society. And it's really detrimental and damaging to people's sense of belonging. And why would you expect somebody to continue to contribute to a society that doesn't want them? I'd also say maybe restricted services in terms of accessing the NHS, education as well. So student loans, for example, they aren't a public fund. However, people with no recourse to public funds, when it comes to education, they can't access student loan anyway, but also they can't access any other means of support to enable them to pursue anything or their interests and ambitions. So again, creates a further delay in any sort of life progress. I mean, you'll touch on the fees in a little bit, but the fact that many migrants have no recourse to public funds, but then are in families whereby, I don't know, their mother or their father or their guardian might be working a very low income job. In the event of the current pandemic, you know, there is no guarantee that they can keep that job. And as a result, you find people can't pay their rent. They're facing eviction. Obviously, if that happens, you can't pay the high fees that you have to renew your stay. You're left destitute. You don't really have any support. You can't go to the local council because you don't have that privilege. And as a result, I think just pushing people further and further into homelessness.
I think that's it. Because the numbers are, as far as we know, are fairly high, it's likely most people with no recourse to public funds are able to, you know, to work in a lot of cases, and it doesn't impact them. Of course, for undocumented migrants, they don't have the right to work, and so that's a bit more difficult. So that means that there's a chance that they're much more likely to be in labour or sexual exploitation. But for most people, as long as they're able to work, then it won't impact in terms of access to services too much. The danger is, yeah, when people lose a job or they reach a crisis point or if they're evicted from their home. And that's when it really kicks in, because it's not possible to get the support that most people would be able to expect.
You know, I guess this, use that safety net.
Right. You know, and the impacts are huge. There was a case a couple of years ago now where there was a mother and her daughter. So the mother's name was Lillian Ollock, and her daughter was called Lynn Matumba. I think she was 2 years old, and they had no recourse to public funds. They were being supported by children's services, and they starved to death. And so that's that's the sharp end of what these policies can do. And, you know, if you look at serious case reviews of child deaths, over the past 10 years, there's dozens where the family's immigration status meant that they would have no recourse to public funds. Now, that's not to say that that was the only factor in the child's death, but it's a factor that makes it much more difficult for families to get support, and it pushes people into quite desperate situations.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very, almost like it's a cyclical thing or a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense that, as you say, in normal circumstances, things might be fine, but as soon as something starts to go wrong and there's a crisis or you lose a job, that then it starts to go wrong very, very quickly, you know, like the situation will deteriorate pretty dramatically without that safety net. One of the issues that's been talked about a lot over the last few weeks, kind of over the course of the pandemic, is the idea of the health surcharge. What is this, and, you know, how does that affect people?
The health surcharge, it's like a levy, a mandatory one. It was introduced in 2015, I believe, for temporary migrants to contribute towards their healthcare. And it's not a one-off payment. It's something that temporary migrants have to pay with every renewal. So by temporary, I mean people with limited leave or visitors' visas. And I was actually looking, I mean, on the government website, it details who can pay, when you can start to pay. But what I find interesting on these guidelines is that it states that it is for people who are not applying to remain in the UK permanently. And of course, we know that many migrants who pay this NIHS, they're not here temporarily. They are here on a permanent basis. However, they're just granted temporary leave. And as a result of that, they have to continue to contribute towards this levy, as well as their normal NI contributions. So it's essentially double taxing temporary migrants. And by minimizing the numbers of people that get permanent residence and attaching temporary leave to each application and delaying the processing of that and increasing the fees each time, it's almost as though it's purposefully being done to continuously move that goalpost further. So keeping people on a long timeline where they have to continuously pay to contribute over and over again.
And why it was in the news recently was that the government had a manifesto commitment to increase the levy and to extend it to EEA nationals after the end of the transition period. And what happened was that people were angry because that would include NHS workers, which they've now agreed to change. But the problem with policies like this is that they have a wider chilling effect. So if it's known that there are restrictions on people accessing the NHS, and if people are told that they need to pay their way, then that impacts on more than the people that it's targeted for. So there was a recent article in the BMJ, which talks about the migrant cost recovery program, which is where the NHS are encouraged to recover costs for temporary migrants of the use of the NHS. So it's a previous program. And they found that meant that treatment times for TB were lengthened. Of course, for tuberculosis, that's an infectious disease, and it means that there's a public health impact in terms of that spreading. And we don't have the data yet on COVID-19, but the danger is that these kind of restrictive policies on accessing healthcare mean that people are less likely to want to access the NHS, even if they're able to. And in a pandemic, that's particularly dangerous. Mm.
Yeah, I suppose it's dangerous at the public health level, potentially also hugely detrimental to the individuals themselves, you know, where they're unable to get treatment or just afraid if they could. I suppose that leads very neatly into how the hostile environment is enforced and the consequences of that.
I suppose there's a few ways. So I guess the most invasive is the way that the general public and health and care workers are kind of enlisted as kind of border guards. So you can see that in the right to rent policy, which restricted the ability of people who had an irregular migration status from accessing private rented accommodation. So landlords were expected to check people's immigration status. And you can also see that in information sharing between care services and the NHS and the Home Office. So if a family approach children's services for support and they've got an irregular immigration status, children's services will pass that information onto the Home Office. So it makes landlords and care workers and also NHS staff in a kind of border guard role. So that kind of changes their relationship between them and the service users. But it also makes people less likely to want to access care or support or to rent accommodation. And that, again, kind of increases people's isolation and lack of access to services.
I completely agree with that. And I think the fact that it even stems off and extends, I mean, I know you've mentioned, you know, NHS and children's support services, but also schools. There are many instances of schools' data sharing. And it's just, you wonder how the data is shared and what is it, what's the algorithm in terms of what is actually particularly being looked for. And there is the idea of racial bias, maybe looking at names that sound, you know, visibly foreign, and then that being used to create this mandate for racial discrimination. There was a recent news article by Channel 4 on NHS trusts, and in that there was an example of a family who was sent a letter. I think it was a patient that was recovering from COVID, or he'd received COVID treatment, and they received a letter asking to prove entitlement for care while that patient was still in hospital. I think fortunately for the family, the patient was actually a British citizen, it was found. However, you know, had the patient had been somebody with limited leave or perhaps undocumented, even more so, it creates that fear. And it just extends into ordinary citizens being made to be Home Office enforcers. There's this culture of surveillance even, where you feel as though, you know, do I have to look at my next door neighbour and question things? It just grows a big sense of distrust. And I don't think those are the foundations of a thriving, welcoming community. It then feeds in more into that overarching idea of, yes, it is going to be hostile because everybody's looking out to catch you out. I mean, I work directly with young people who have temporary status. And from conversations, there is an idea of feeling guilty and distrusted before you've even done anything. And that's very unsettling.
What would you say the biggest challenges faced by them, you know, as young people are? Like, what would they identify as the key issues to change about the policy or what they would like to see?
I think they'd like to see massively big changes in education. A lot of them face, you know, delayed gap years and futures due to narrowed guidelines as a result of their status. It's almost as though the colour of your passport holds a great bearing to your success. So looking at the fees, I'm just going to touch on the IHS fees as part of this. They were set to increase, I think, from the Chancellor's recent announcement of the budget to £624. So adding that to the normal price of the applications, I think it was a staggering £2,593 total of an application that an individual and a family has to pay. And so for the young people that I work with and for many young migrants, this is unaffordable for starters. And not only that, you are being classified as an international student or as an overseas student when it comes to making university applications. By the time you reach post 16, you are being asked to provide documents to prove whether you can still access education services. And I think it delays migrants' futures. So I'd say to start off with, that cost is unaffordable and young migrants would call for the cost to be reduced. And not only that, to suspend all NHS charging or data sharing between NHS and immigration enforcement and allow access to public services and extend visas for limited leave to remain or even shorten the route. Because currently, the particular group of young migrants that I work with, they are on what's called a 10-year route to settlement. So in the first 10 years of your working life, you're practically working to just contribute to your stay and your status. There is nothing else. You can't save up for your first home. You can't afford to pay driving lessons at the age of 18 because everything you're working towards, all your family's contributions are just to merely keep you alive and keep that status going.
And the £2,500 you mentioned in terms of an application fee, is that to universities or is that?
No, so that's just your Home Office application in addition to the immigration health surcharge. So I think £2,593, if I'm correct, but I'd have to double check those numbers. Because again, things are always changing.
Yeah, it's a really significant amount of money though.
It is. And I mean, I remember when I was 18 years old, wanting to sort of take on driving lessons as well as go to university. I wasn't afforded those luxuries. I had to delay and save up and just live every month in a sort of box because you're saving towards your your stay constantly, and you cannot risk not having that money by the time your application comes, because if you are unable to afford or you can't pay it, there is no exceptions. I mean, it's rare that you get an exception, but there are no exceptions, and you might risk falling off your 10-year route and having to start all over again. So what you then get is families with mixed statuses, whether it's because, you know, parents may not be able to afford to pay for one sibling, they have to choose, okay, which sibling are we going to regularise? So it's just
an incredibly difficult decision to make, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. But you're not given a choice, and there is no social security net to fall back on.
I think what is really useful is to talk about some of the solutions. And I think there's a couple of things. I think Kimberly mentioned suspending the NRPF policy in its entirety. There's been a few MPs that have been calling for that, and a lot of civil society organisations too. Because it's such a public health issue, it's not an issue of immigration control, it's about public health in the pandemic. If some people aren't safe, then none of us are safe. So I think that's one really practical thing that could be done really quickly.
That's had a bit of attention to recently, like I've come across that in terms of people, you know, too, we're talking about like delivery drivers or people working in different roles that may be affected by NRPF, but
yeah,
who still have to go out and work because there's no alternative.
Yeah, absolutely. And so people who know that they don't have a safety net, then they're far less likely to be able to not work, but also are far less likely to be able to shield or to socially distance, even if they're not working. So from my research, there's a huge number of people who are living in HMOs or are sofa surfing. So they might be living with a friend in kind of overcrowded conditions. So that is a big issue. And then also the issue of either not being able to access or being afraid of accessing healthcare and presenting later on than they would otherwise. These are public health issues anyway. And when we look at the evidence about people with TB who are less likely to present or to present later, but in the current pandemic, there it's particularly dangerous. So that I think that's one practical thing that can be done for the duration of the pandemic. And you know that was quite a radical idea, but as I say, it's gained a bit of traction because things have changed since the pandemic. And the second thing is I mentioned information sharing between the Home Office, Immigration Control, and public services. And one thing that can be done is to introduce firewalls between public services and immigration control. So that just means that services don't pass on information for people who are accessing either healthcare or social care. And that means that people aren't afraid to access help. And it means that medical staff and social workers, social care staff, aren't put in an ethical dilemma where they have a choice between obeying what the policy is saying, what the law says, and obeying their kind of professional ethical standards. And there's some precedent for that. It happens in Sweden, although it has been weakened slightly recently, but there are firewalls at a municipal level, and particularly in Malmö, they exist. Also in the Netherlands, and the Sanctuary City movement in the US is another example of that. Although again, that has been weakened. So it is possible to put these things in place, and they have a real tangible effect in people being able to access support.
There must be support amongst medical staff and practitioners as well for that type of thing, because it takes them out of a very, you know, an awkward and difficult position that they're not trained to do, you know, that they're not employed to do.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it's so embedded within kind of medical ethics that people should be treated on basis of need rather than anything else, that it's incredibly difficult for medical staff to work within these conditions. And so, yeah, there's an organisation called Docs Not Cops, which campaigns around this issue. It's kind of got less traction within social work and social care for some reason, but exactly the same issues exist.
Mm.
So what does no recourse to public funds mean for the enjoyment of social and economic rights in the UK? Here's Cordo Kassler on how the policy breaches rights and what the UK should be doing to comply with its human rights obligations.
What rights are affected by no recourse to public funds and the hostile environment generally?
So no recourse to public funds puts at risk two important social economic rights that the UK has voluntarily subscribed to internationally. It breaches the right to social security, recognised in Article 9 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and it also breaches the right to an adequate standard of living, recognised in Article 11 of the same treaty. And there are other treaties in relation to women's rights and children's rights, and also the European Social Charter that won't be affected by Brexit, which also recognise both the right to social security and the right to an adequate standard of living. In particular, one of the obligations of the state is the obligation to respect, protect and fulfil social economic rights in a non-discriminatory way. And that includes discrimination based on nationality and migration status. And non-recourse to public funds puts or creates a policy situation by which people, because of the nationality and because of the migration status, are in a worse situation than the rest. So the principle of non-discrimination is breached by non-recourse to public funds. And also in this moment, it creates a public health risk because a lot of people are forced with COVID-19 are forced to choose between staying at home or feeding their children. It is in the interest of no one from a pure public health perspective to create this situation. Finally, specifically in relation to children, it is particularly harmful for them. It breaches the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It also breaches Children's Act 1989, which incorporates the Convention on the Rights of the Child in the UK. And research in the UK has shown that there are substantial differences between local authorities in how they are complying with Children's Act in relation to children of families that are not entitled or are affected by non-recourse to public funds. We need to remember that in those 30 years, funding to local authorities was cut by more than 50% from central government. So some local authorities have suffered austerity more than others, and some of them, either because of lack of resources or because of ideological reasons, are not protecting children's rights despite the Children's Act 1989 in relation to those children that are affected by non-recourse to public funds.
So you mentioned the Respect, Protect, Fulfill framework and the fact that the no-recourse to public funds policy brings into play a number of different rights. What should the UK be doing then to comply with its human rights obligations?
So in recent years, both the UN Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights have condemned the UK's policy in relation to migrants' access to social security because both the right to social security and the right to an adequate standard of living are being breached. And they are being breached because the policy is inherently discriminatory. And the government has implemented regressive measures during the austerity years. Not only that, but some groups that are particularly vulnerable, like children, have suffered the consequences more than others. So the government needs to put an end to non-recourse to public funds and needs to develop policy in relation to social security that is in line with international human rights law. And hopefully, eventually, Parliament will see light and will decide to come up with a piece of legislation that will recognise that social security is a human rights and a condition for the fulfilment of all other rights, just like the Social Security Act 2018 says.
You mentioned briefly the principle of non-retrogression. Could you just describe what that is for people who don't know?
Sure. The principle of non-retrogression is a requirement in human rights by which when governments, because of the economic circumstances, need to adopt policies that look regressive, in other words, investing less or spending less on social protection because the circumstances are more difficult, they need to do it in a way that is compliant with certain human rights-based requirements. Among other things, the measure has to be proportionate. It has to be necessary, so the government has to prove that the measure is going to fulfill the declared goal. It has to be done in a way that doesn't incur in discrimination. It also has to be done in a way that is participatory, so you have to listen to people that are going to be affected by it. And it has to be done in a way that protects the interests and the needs of those who are more vulnerable in particular. So children is one of them. The policies implemented in the UK since 2012, the austerity-driven policies, have constituted a clear violation of these principles in relation to social security, not only for non-recourse to public funds, but the whole package of welfare reforms 2012 and 2016, the disproportionate use of sanctions, the unbalanced use of conditionality, benefit freeze, benefits cuts, all of that, and digital by default. So this policy by which you assume that people who are entitled to social security benefits have access to online tools, which is clearly not the case with digital divides. So all these package of reforms have been a clear violation of the right to social security and the adequate standard of living from the perspective of the principle of non-retrogression. That's why we need this principle and these rights to be recognised in UK law and in housing policy.
And finally, how are people using human rights to challenge the hostile environment and the no recourse to public funds policy?
A number of very talented lawyers and campaigners are using the Human Rights Act to challenge some of these policies, regressive policies of the last decades in courts. and they are relying on the Human Rights Act, which incorporates the European Convention of Human Rights in UK law. They are using the right to family life, private and family life, Article 8, and the principle of non-discrimination, Article 14. However, these articles and the Act itself are proven insufficient because neither the right to adequate standard of living nor social security are recognized in the Human Rights Act. Some achievements can be celebrated in recent years, but we need these rights incorporated in UK law. We need to follow the model of the Scottish Social Security Act 2016 and recognize that these rights are human rights and allow campaigners to champion these rights in the policy work, but also lawyers to secure these rights in court.
Thank you for listening to this episode of RightsCast from the University of Essex Human Rights Centre. You can subscribe to RightsCast and find more of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please share with your friends and leave us a review if you feel like it. We'll be back soon with more regular episodes.